to Lourdes and Motella's flight to Kai Doug, heads seriously waltzed around with by Darvon, Speed, PX Beer, Vietnamese weed, and airport coffee, so as to be broadly incapable of the customary airplane chit-chat, and thus, as the ladies told it, scarcely were the seat belt lights off than Lourdes and Joaquin, Motella and Cookie, respectively, found themselves in adjoining lavatories fucking each other's brains out. The frolicking continued through the girls' layover in Hong Kong, while the containers of currency grew more and more difficult to locate, not to mention believe in, though Cookie and Joaquin did try, whenever lulls in recreation allowed, to pursue an increasingly half-hearted search for them. Club Asiatique was in San Pedro, opposite Terminal Island, with a filtered view of the Vincent Thomas Bridge. At night it seemed covered, in a way protected, by something deeper than shadow, a visual expression of the convergence from all around the Pacific Rim of numberless needs to do business unobserved. Glassware behind the bar, which might in some other type of saloon have been found too dazzling, here achieved the smudged cool glow of images on cheap black and white TV sets. Waitresses in black silk chansams, printed with red tropical blossoms, glided around on high heels, bearing tall, narrow drinks decorated with real orchids and mango slices, and straws of vivid aqua plastic molded to look like bamboo. Customers at tables leaned toward each other and then away in slow rhythms, like plants underwater. House regulars drank shots of hot sake, chased with iced champagne. The air was dense with smoke from opium pipes and cannabis bongs, as well as clove cigarettes. Malaysian cheroots and correctional system cools, glowing foci of awareness pulsing brighter and dimmer everywhere in the dusk. Downstairs, for those nostalgic for Macau and the joys of Felicidad Street, an exclusive Fantan game went on day and night, as well as Mahjong and Dollar a Stone Go in various alcoves behind the bead curtains. "Now, Doc, my man," Motella warned as they slid into a booth upholstered with some tiger skin print in nail polish purple and vivid rust. "Remember, me and Lourdes springin' for this, so tonight it's well drinks only. None of that little umbrella shit." Plenty cool with Doc, considering the income disparity situation and all. Cookie and Joaquin showed up just as the house band was percolating into a zippy version of the Doors' People Are Strange, When You're a Stranger, sporting wide-brimmed Panama hats, counterfeit designer shades, and white civilian suits bought off some rack in Kaiser Estates, Kowloon, sauntering in step, one step per beat, each waving a forefinger in the air, down into the echoless reaches of the club. "Joaquin! Cookie!" called the girls. "Oh, wow! Dig it! Looking so groovy!" and so forth. Though few men indeed can be copacetic enough with their lives that they won't go for public appreciation like this, Doc also could see Joaquin and Cookie looking at each other thinking, "Shit, man, I wonder how he does it." "May have to leave in a hurry, may cherie," rumbled Cookie, burying one hand in Motella's afro and getting into a kiss of some duration. "Nothing personal," added Joaquin. "Kind of a short-notice business trip," enveloping Lourdes in a possibly even more passionate embrace, interrupted by a well-known bass line from the band, who were hidden in a small grove of indoor palm trees. "All right," Motella, seizing Cookie by his necktie, which had a picture of a florid Pacific lagoonscape in psychedelic colors. "Let's get down!" In 2 seconds, Joaquin had disappeared under the table. "What's this?" Lourdes, keeping her composure. Some psychological shit from the NAM. Cookie dancing away. Every time people say that, he does it. It's okay, folks, called Joaquin, who had spent the war trying to make some money and wouldn't know a LZ if it ran up and started firing some rockets at its ass. I like it down here. You don't mind, do you, Mia Moore? I suppose I could think of it as being out with somebody real short, with her arms folded and a bright smile that was maybe a little higher on one side than the other. A small, perfect Asian dewdrop in the house getup, who on closer inspection seemed to be Jade, came over to Doc. There are a couple of gentlemen, she murmured, real eager to see these boys, even to the point of handing out 20s right and left. Joaquin stuck his head out from under the tablecloth. Where are they? We'll finger somebody else and then we'll be $20 ahead. $40, corrected Lourdes. Ordinarily a sound plan, said Motella, returning with Cookie. Except everybody here knows you two, and as a matter of fact, here comes the folks in question right now. Oh, shit, it's Blondie-san, said Cookie. He looked pissed off to you? I think he's pissed off. Nah, said Joaquin, he ain't pissed off. But I'm not so sure about his partner there. Blondie-san wore a blonde toupee that wouldn't have fooled nobody's abuelita back in South Pass, and a black business suit of vaguely mob-connected cut, cranked up, prickly-eyed, and chain-smoking cheap Japanese cigarettes. He was accompanied by a Yakuza torpedo named Iwao, the spiritual purity of whose don ranking had long been compromised by a taste for unprovoked ass-kicking, his eyes sliding back and forth and his face wrinkling in thought as he tried to figure out who was to be his primary target here. Doc hated to see anybody that confused, plus which, the more deeply Cookie and Joaquin were drawn into discussion with Blondie-san, the less attention they paid to Lourdes and Motella, making the ladies that much crazier and more susceptible to those grand emotional disasters they shared such a taste for, none of which boded well. Around then, Jade happened by again. "Thought that was you," Doc said, "though we ain't exactly been wallering in eye contact. Got your note at the office. But why'd you go running away like that? We could have hung out, you know, smoked some shit." "Like there are these creeps in a barracuda that tailgated us all the way from Hollywood. Could have been anybody, and we didn't want to get you in any more trouble than you are, so we pretended we were there for the B-12 shots, and I guess that made us a little speedy, so when we saw you, we got paranoid and split." "Better not be negotiating those Singapore slings over there," Motella advised. "None of that shit." "She's an old schoolmate. We're reminiscing about the prom. Geometry class. Lighten up, Motella." "What school was that? Tehachapi?" "Ooh," went Lourdes. The girls were on edge, and strong drink was not improving their mood. "See me outside," Jade whispered, high-heeling away. The nearly total absence of lighting in the parking lot could have been deliberate, to suggest oriental intrigue and romance, though it also looked like a crime scene waiting on its next crime. Doc noticed a 56 Fireflight ragtop, which seemed to be breathing deeply, as if it had raced all the way down here gathering pinks as it came, and was trying to think of how he could discreetly pop the hood and just have a look at the Hemi beneath, when Jade showed up. "I can't stay out here long. We're in Golden Fang territory, and a girl doesn't necessarily want to get into difficulties with those folks." "This is the same Golden Fang you said to beware of in your note? What is it, some band?" "You wish." She made a "my lips are zipped" gesture. "You're not going to tell me? after beware of and so forth? No, I really only wanted to say how sorry I am. I just feel so shitty about what I did. Which was, what again? I'm not a snitch, she cried. The cops told us they'd drop charges if we just put you at the scene, which they already knew you were, so where was the harm? And I must have panicked, and really, Larry, I am, like, so sorry. Call me Doc. It's cool, Jade. They had to cut me loose. Now they just tail me every place is all. Here. He found a pack of smokes, tapped in on the side of his hand, held it out. She took one. They lit up. That copper, she said. You must mean Bigfoot. Some warped sheet of plastic, that one. Did he ever come around your salon, by any chance? Looked in now and then. Not the way a cop would do, not like expecting freebies or whatever. If this guy was being paid off, it was more like some private deal with Mr. Wolfman. And don't take it personally, but was it Bigfoot himself who put me on the Buenos Noches Express, or did he subcontract it? She shrugged. Missed all that. Bambi and me were so freaked with that badass brigade stomping in, we didn't stick around. How about those jailhouse Nazis that were supposed to be covering Mickey's back? All over the place one minute, gone the next. Too bad. We were their damn PX there for a while. We even got to where we could tell them apart and whatever. They all disappeared? Was that before or after the fun started? Before, like a raid, when people know it's going to happen. They all cleared out except for Glenn. He was the only one who... She paused, as if trying to remember the word for it. Stayed. She dropped her cigarette on the blacktop and squashed it with the pointed toe of her shoe. Listen, there's somebody who wants to talk to you. You mean I should get out of here quick? No. He thinks you can help each other out. He's a new face. I'm not even sure of his name, but I know he's in some trouble. She headed back inside. Out of the onshore mists, known to shroud this piece of waterfront, another figure now emerged. Doc wasn't always that easy to creep out, but still wished he hadn't waited around. He recognized this party from the Polaroid that Hope had given him. It was Coy Harlingen, newly returned from the next world, where death, along with its other side effects, had destroyed any fashion sense the tenor player might have had left when he OD'd, resulting in painter's overalls, a pink button-down shirt from the 50s with a narrow black-knit tie, and ancient pointed cowboy boots. Howdy, Coy.
I would have come to your office, ma'am, but I thought there might be unfriendly eyeballs.
Doc needed an ear trumpet or something, because along with the horns and bells out in the harbor, Coy also had this tendency to fall into a nearly inaudible junkie's murmur. Is this safe enough for you out here? Doc said.
Let's light this up and pretend we came out to smoke it.
Asian indica, heavily aromatic. Doc prepared to be knocked on his ass, but instead found a perimeter of clarity not too hard to stay inside of. The glow at the end of the joint was blurred by the fog, and its color kept shifting between orange and an intense pink.
I'm supposed to be dead, Coy said.
There's also a rumor you're not.
That don't come as such great news. Being dead is part of my job image, like what I do.
You working for these people here at the club?
Don't know. Maybe. It's where I come to pick up my paycheck.
Where are you staying?
House up in Topanga Canyon. A band I used to play for, the Boards. But none of them know it's me.
How can they not know it's you?
Even when I was alive, they didn't know it was me. The sax player, basically. The session guy. Plus, over the years, there's been this big turnover of personnel. Like, the boards I played with have most of them gone off by now and formed other bands. Only one or two of the old crew are left. And they're suffering, or do I mean blessed, with heavy doper's memory. Story was you came to grief behind some bad smack. You still into that? No, God, no, I'm clean these days. I was in a place up near. A long silence and a stare, while Coy wondered if he'd said too much and tried to figure what else Doc might know. Actually, I'd appreciate it if...
It's okay, said Doc.
I can't hear you too good. And how can I talk about what I don't hear? Sure. There was something I wanted to see you about.
Doc thought he caught a note in Coy's voice. Not exactly accusing, but still sweeping Doc in somehow with some bigger injustice. Doc peered at Coy's intermittently distinct face, the drops of fog condensed on his beard, shining in the lights from the Club Asiatique, a million separate little halos radiating all colors of the spectrum, and understood that regardless of who in this might help whom, Coy was going to require a light touch.
Sorry, man. What can I do for you? It wouldn't be nothing heavy. Just wondering if you could check in on a couple of people. Lady and a little girl. See that they're okay, that's all. And without bringing me into it.
Where are they staying?
Torrance?
He handed over a scrap of paper with Hope and Amethyst street address.
Easy drive for me. Probably won't even have to charge you for mileage. You don't have to go in and talk to anybody. Just see if they're still living there. What's in the driveway? Who's going in and out? Law enforcement in the picture. Any details you find interesting. I'm on it. I can't pay you right now.
When you can. Whenever. Unless maybe you're one of these folks who believe information is money. In which case... Could I just ask?
Bear in mind that either I don't know, or it'll be my ass if I tell you. What is it, man?
Ever heard of the Golden Fang?
Sure.
Was that a hesitation? How long is too long?
It's a boat.
Awfully interesting. Doc sang more than spoke, in the way Californians do to indicate it isn't interesting at all. Since when do you beware of a boat?
Seriously, a big schooner, I think somebody said. Brings stuff in and out of the country, but nobody wants to talk about what exactly. That blonde Japanese guy tonight with the badass sidekick who's talking to your friends? He'd know.
Because? Instead of answering, Coy nodded somberly over Doc's shoulder, across the parking lot, down the street at the main channel and the outer harbor beyond. Doc turned and thought he saw something white moving out there, but the fog coming in made everything deceptive. By the time he got to the street, there was nothing to see.
That was it, Coy said.
How do you know?
Saw it sail in. Got here about the same time I did tonight.
I don't know what I saw.
Me neither. Fact, I don't even want to know.
Back inside, Doc found the light apparently shifted to more of an ultraviolet mode, because the parrots on his shirt had now begun to stir and flap, to squawk, and maybe even talk, though that could also have been from smoke. Lourdes and Matella, meanwhile, were behaving very badly indeed, having chosen to assault a couple of local gun malls as a sort of tag team, for which waiters and waitresses keeping semi-visible, had relocated a couple of tables in order to clear a space, and customers had gathered around to give encouragement. Clothing was ripped, hairdos disarranged, skin exposed, and many holes with sexual subtexts wriggled into and out of. The usual allurements of girl wrestling. Cookie and Joaquin were still deep in conversation with Blondie-san. Iwao, the torpedo, was busy watching the girls. Doc edged closer into earshot.
"Just conferenced with the partners by satellite," Blondie-san was saying. "And the best offer is 3 per unit.
"Maybe I'll go back and re-enlist," muttered Joaquin. "Make more off of the bonus than I will this."
"He's only being emotional," Cookie said. "We'll take it."
"You take it, Ese. I ain't gonna take it."
"I need not remind you," said Blondie-san with sinister amusement, "that this is the Golden Fang."
"Best we not be messing with no Golden Fang," Cookie agreed.
"Carajo!" Joaquin, in a violent double-take. "What are those chicks doing over there?"
Chapter 7 Doc called Sancho next morning and asked if he ever heard of a boat called the Golden Fang. Sancho grew strangely evasive.
"Before I forget, was that a diamond ring on Ginger last episode?"
"You sure you didn't? Like, hey, I was on the Natch. I just couldn't get a good look. And how about all those goo-goo eyes at the skipper? I didn't even know they were dating."
"Must have missed that," said Doc.
"I mean, I always figured she'd end up with Gilligan somehow."
Nah. Thurston Howell III. Come on, he'd never divorce Lovey."
There was a pulse of embarrassed silence as both men realized that this could all be construed as code for Shasta Fay and Mickey Wolfman, and incredibly, even Doc himself.
"The reason I was asking about this boat," Doc said finally, is that..."
"Okay, how about..." Sancho, a little abrupt. "You know the yacht harbor in San Pedro? There's a local fish place called the Belayan Pin. Meet me there for lunch. I'll tell you what I can."
From the smell that hit him when he walked in, Doc wouldn't have ranked the Belaying Pin as one of your more health-conscious seafood joints. The clientele, however, were not as easy to read.
"It isn't new money, exactly," Sancho suggested. "More like new debt. Everything they own, including their sailboats, they bought on credit cards from institutions in places like South Dakota that you send away for by filling out the back of a match cover."
They threaded their way among plasticratic yachtsfolk, seated at tables made from varathaned hatch covers, to a booth by a window in back, looking out on the water.
"The pin's where I like to take very special clients, and I also figured you'd want to see the view."
Doc looked out the window.
"Is that what I think it is?"
Sancho had a pair of ancient World War II field glasses on a strap around his neck. He took them off and handed them to Doc.
"Meet the schooner Golden Fang, out of Charlotte Amalia."
"Where's that?"
"Virgin Islands."
"Bermuda Triangle?"
"Close enough."
"Sizable vessel."
Doc regarded the elegantly swept yet somehow, what would you call it, inhuman lines of the Golden Fang, everything about her gleaming a little too purposefully, more antennas and radomes than any boat could possibly use. Not a flag of national origin in sight. Weather decks of teak or maybe mahogany, not likely intended for relaxing out on with no fishing line or can of beer.
"She has a tendency to show up unannounced in the middle of the night," Sancho said. "No running lights, no radio traffic."
Local sophisticates, assuming her visit to be drug-related, might lurk hopefully for a day or two, but would soon drift away, muttering about intimidation. By whom was never quite made clear. The harbor master went around in a state of nerves, as if coerced into waiving all the fees applying to transients, and every time the office radio kicked in, he was seen to jump violently. So, who's the mob kingpin that owns this? Doc saw no harm in asking. Actually, we've considered hiring you to find out.
Me?
Off and on. Thought you guys all dialed in on this, Sanch. For years, Sancho had kept a watchful eye on the yachting community in Southern California as they came and went, at first feeling the unavoidable class hatred such vessels, for all their beauty under sail, inspire in those of average income, but evolving after a while into fantasies about going in with somebody, maybe even Doc, on a boat, some little snipe or Lido class day sailor at least. As it turned out, his firm, Hardy, Gridley, and Chatfield, had been keenly, almost desperately curious about the Golden Fang for a while now. Her insurance history was an exercise in mystification, sending bewildered clerks and even partners clear back to 19th century commentators like Thomas Arnold and Theophilus Parsons, usually screaming. Tentacles of sin and desire and that strange whirlbound karma, which is of the essence in maritime law, crept through all areas of Pacific sailing culture. And ordinarily it would have taken no more than a fraction of the firm's weekly entertainment budget, deployed at a carefully selected handful of local marina bars, to find out anything they wanted to know from nightly chatter. Yarns of Tahiti, Mo'orea, Bora Bora, dropped names of rogue mates and legendary vessels, and what had happened aboard or might have, and who still haunts the cabin spaces, and what old karma lies unavenged, waiting its moment.
I'm Clorinda. What'll it be?
A waitress in a combination Nehru jacket and Hawaiian print shirt, just long enough to qualify as a mini-dress, and with a set of vibes that didn't help sharpen anybody's appetite. Ordinarily, I'd go for the Admiral's luau, Sancho more diffident than Doc expected. But today I guess I'll just have the house anchovy loaf to start and, the devil ray filet. Can I get that deep-fried in beer batter?
Your stomach, isn't it? How about you, little buddy?
Doc scanning the menu. All this good eatin', while Sancho kicked him under the table.
If my husband dared to eat any of this shit, I'd throw him out on his ass and drop all his iron butterfly albums out the window after him.
Trick question, Doc said hastily. The, jellyfish teriyaki croquettes, I guess? And the eel travatora.
And to drink, gentlemen?
You'll want to be good and fucked up by the time this arrives.
I'd recommend tequila zombies. They work pretty quick.
She stalked away, scowling. Sancho had been gazing out at the schooner. See, the problem with this vessel is trying to find out anything. People back off, change the subject even. I don't know, get creepy. Head for the toilet, never to reappear. Again, Doc thought he saw in Sancho's expression a strange element of desire. Her name isn't really the Golden Fang. No. Her original name was Preserved, after her miraculous escape in 1917 from a tremendous nitroglycerin explosion in Halifax Harbor, which blew away most everything else in it, shipping and souls. Preserved was a Canadian fishing schooner, which later, during the 1920s and 30s, also picked up a reputation as a racer, competing regularly with others in her class, including, at least twice, the legendary Blue Nose.
Shortly after World War II, as fishing schooners were giving way to diesel-powered craft, she was bought by Burke Stodger, a movie star of the period who not long after got blacklisted for his politics and was forced to take his boat and split the country. "Which is where the Bermuda Triangle comes in," recounted Sancho. "Somewhere between San Pedro and Papeete, the ship disappears. At first, everybody assumes she's been sunk by the Seventh Fleet, acting on direct orders from the U.S. government. Naturally, the Republicans in power deny all involvement. The paranoia keeps growing, till one day, a couple years later, boat and owner suddenly reappear, preserved in the opposite ocean, off Cuba, and Burke Stodger on the front page of Weekly Variety, in an article reporting his return to pictures in a big-budget major studio project called Commie Confidential. The schooner, meantime, instantly, as if by occult forces, relocated to the other side of the planet, has been refitted stem to stern, including the removal of any traces of soul into what you see out there. The owners are listed as a consortium in the Bahamas, and she's been renamed the Golden Fang. That's all we've got so far. I know why I'm so interested, but how come you are? Story I heard the other night, maybe some kind of a smuggling angle. That would be one way of putting it. The ordinarily light-hearted attorney seemed a little bummed today. Another way of putting it is better she should have got blown to bits in Halifax 50 years ago than be in the situation she's in now. Sancho, get that weird look off your face, man. You'll wreck my appetite. As attorney to client, this story you heard, it didn't happen to include Mickey Wolfman. Not so far, why? According to Scuttlebutt, shortly before his disappearance, everybody's favorite developer was observed going on board the Golden Fang. Took a little excursion out into the ocean and back again. Like what the skipper might call a 3-hour tour. And wait, I'll bet he was also accompanied by his lovely companion. Thought you were done with that sad bullshit. Here, let me order you a Boilermaker or something to go with that zombie. You can start the whole sordid thing over again. Just asking. So, everybody got back okay? Nobody pushed over the side, nothing like that? Well, strangely enough, my source in the federal courthouse claims he did see something go over the side. Maybe not a person. It looked to him more like weighted containers, maybe what we call logging, which is stuff you sink deliberately so you can come back and get it later. They, what, put out a buoy or something to mark the spot? Nowadays it's all electronic, Doc. You get your latitude and longitude fixed from Loring coordinates, and then when you want to zero in closer, you run a sonar scan. Sounds like you're planning to go out and have a look. More like a civilian on a ride-along. People at the courthouse who know I'm... He tried to think of the word. Interested. Putting it kindly, long as you don't call it obsessed. If it was a chick, maybe, Doc thought, hoping his lips weren't moving. As usual these days, Fritz was back in the computer room, staring at data. He had that ask-me-if-I-give-a-shit look Doc had noted before in newcomers to the groovy world of addictive behavior. Word is that your girlfriend has split the country. Sorry to be the one to hand you the news. Doc was surprised at the intensity of the rectogenital throb that ran through him. Where'd she go? Not known. She was aboard what the Federals call a vessel of interest, to them and maybe you too. Uh-oh. Doc looked at the printout and saw the name Golden Fang. And you got this from some computer that's hooked up to your network?
This in particular comes from the Hoover Library at Stanford. Somebody's collection of counter-subversive files. Here, I printed it all down.
Doc went out in the front office and drew a cup of coffee from the urn, whereupon Milton the bookkeeper, who had been acting difficult lately, got right into a hassle with Fritz about whether Doc's coffee should be charged to travel and entertainment or to company overhead. Gladys the secretary turned up the office stereo, which happened to be playing Blue Cheer, either to drown out the argument or suggest gently that everybody pipe down. Fritz and Milton then began screaming at Gladys, who screamed back. Doc lit a joint and began to read the file, which had been put together by a private intelligence operation known as the American Security Council, working out of Chicago, according to Fritz, since around 55. There was a brief history of the schooner preserved, of keen interest to the counter-subversive community for her high seas capability. At the time of her reappearance in the Caribbean, for example, she was on some spy mission against Fidel Castro, who by that point was active up in the mountains of Cuba. Later, under the name of Golden Fang, she was to prove of use to anti-communist projects in Guatemala, West Africa, Indonesia, and other places whose names were blanked out. She often took on as cargo abducted local troublemakers, who were never seen again. The phrase, deep interrogation, kept coming up. She ran CIA heroin from the Golden Triangle. She monitored radio traffic off unfriendly coastlines and forwarded it to agencies in Washington, D.C. She brought weapons in to anti-communist guerrillas, including those at the ill-fated Bay of Pigs. The chronology here ran all the way up to the present, including Mickey Wolfman's unexplained day trip just before he vanished, as well as the schooner's departure last week from San Pedro with known Wolfman companion Shasta Faye Hepworth on board. That Mickey, known to be a generous Reagan contributor, might be active in some anti-communist crusade came as no big surprise. But how deeply was Shasta involved? Who had arranged for her passage out of the country aboard the Golden Fang? Was it Mickey? Was it somebody else paying her off for her services and putting the snatch on Mickey? What could she have gotten into so heavy duty that the only way out was to help set up the man she was supposed to be in love with? Bummer man. Bum-er. Assuming she even wanted out. Maybe she really wanted to remain in, whatever it was. And Mickey stood in the way of that. Or maybe Shasta was seeing Sloane's boyfriend Riggs on the side. And maybe Sloane found out and was trying to get revenge by setting Shasta up for Mickey's murder. Or maybe Mickey was jealous of Riggs and tried to have him iced, only the plan misfired, and whoever had contracted to do the deed showed up and by accident killed Mickey. Or maybe it was on purpose because the so far unknown hit person really wanted to run off with Sloane. Gah!
Good shit, ain't it?
Fritz handing back a smoldering roach in a roach clip, all that was left of what they'd been smoking.
Define good, Doc muttered. I am, like, overthinking myself into brain freeze here.
Fritz chuckled at length.
Yeah, PIs should really stay away from drugs. All them alternate universes just make the job that much more complicated. But what about Sherlock Holmes? He did coke all the time, man. It helped him solve cases.
Yeah, but he was not real.
What?
Sherlock Holmes was... He's a made-up character in a bunch of stories, Doc.
What? No,
he's real. He lives at this real address in London. Well, maybe not anymore. It was years ago. He has to be dead by now. Come on, let's go over to Zucky's. I don't know about you, but I've suddenly got this, what Cheech and Chong might call,
Matzoball Jones.
Entering the legendary Santa Monica delicatessen, they came under the red-eyed scrutiny of a crowd of freaks of all ages who seemed to be expecting somebody else. After a while, Magda showed up with the usual Zucky burger and fries, and rolled beef on rye, and potato salad, and Dr. Brown's Celrays, plus another bowl of pickles and sauerkraut, and looking more than ordinarily imposed upon.
"Joint sure is jumping," Doc observed. She rolled her eyes up and down the establishment.
"Marcus Welby, M.D. freaks. You ever notice how the Zucky's sign shows up for half a second in the opening credits? Blink and you'll miss it, but it's more than enough for these people who come in asking if that's, like, Dr. Steve Kiley's motorcycle parked out front, and where's the hospital, and who also..." Her voice rising as she left the table. "Get confused when they can't find Cheetos or Twinkies on the gall-dern menu."
"At least it ain't Mod Squatters," Doc grumbled.
"What?"
Fritz innocently. "My favorite show."
"Pro-cop fucking mind control's more like it. Inform on your friends, kids, get a lollipop from the captain."
"Listen, I came up in Temecula, which is crazy cat country, where you always root for Ignatz and not Officer Pup."
They got into face-stuffing activities for a while, forgetting if they'd ordered anything else, bringing Magda back over, then forgetting what they wanted her for.
"'Cause P.I.'s are doomed, man," Doc continuing his earlier thought. "You could have seen it coming for years in the movies, on the tube. Once, there was all these great old P.I.'s, Philip Marlowe, Sam Spade, the Seamus of Seamuses, Johnny Staccato, always smarter and more professional than the cops, always end up solving the crime while the cops are following wrong leads and getting in the way.
Coming in at the end to put the cuffs on.
Yeah, but nowadays it's all you see anymore is cops. The tube is saturated with fucking cop shows. Just being regular guys only trying to do their job, folks. No more threat to nobody's freedom than some dad in a sitcom."
"Right. Get the viewer population so cop-happy they're begging to be run in. Goodbye, Johnny Staccato. Welcome, and while you're at it, please kick my door down, Steve McGarrett. Meantime, out here in the real world, most of us private flatfoots can't even make the rent."
"So, why do you stay in the business? Want to get a houseboat up in the Sacramento Delta? Smoke, drink, fish, fuck, you know, what old guys do. Don't forget piss and moan."
Sunrise was on the way. The bars were just closed or closing. Out in front of Huevos, everybody was either at the tables along the sidewalk, sleeping with their heads on health waffles or in bowls of vegetarian chili, or being sick in the street, causing small motorcycle traffic to skid in the vomit and so forth. It was late winter in Gordita, though for sure not the usual weather. You heard people muttering to the effect that last summer the beach didn't have summer till August, and now there probably wouldn't be any winter till spring. Santa Ana's had been blowing all the smog out of downtown L.A., funneling between the Hollywood and Puente Hills, on westward through Gordita Beach and out to sea. And this had been going on for what seemed like weeks now. Offshore winds had been too strong to be doing the surf much good, but surfers found themselves getting up early anyway to watch the dawn weirdness, which seemed like a visible counterpart to the feeling in everybody's skin of desert winds and heat and relentlessness, with the exhaust from millions of motor vehicles mixing with microfine Mojave sand to refract the light toward the bloody end of the spectrum. Everything dim, lurid, and biblical. Sailor-take-warning skies. The state liquor stamps over the tops of tequila bottles in the stores were coming unstuck, is how dry the air was.
Liquor store owners could be filling those bottles with anything anymore. Jets were taking off the wrong way from the airport. The engine sounds were not passing across the sky where they should have. So everybody's dreams got disarranged when people could get to sleep at all. In the little apartment complexes, the wind entered, narrowing to whistle through the stairwells and ramps and catwalks, and the leaves of the palm trees outside rattled together with a liquid sound, so that from inside, in the darkened rooms, in louvered light, it sounded like a rainstorm, the wind raging in the concrete geometry, the palms beating together like the rush of a tropical downpour, enough to get you to open the door and look outside. And of course, they'd only be the same hot, cloudless depth of day, no rain in sight. For the last few weeks now, Saint Flip of Lawndale, for whom Jesus Christ was not only personal savior but surfing consultant as well, who rode an old-school redwood plank running just under 10 feet with an inlaid mother-of-pearl cross on top and two plastic skegs of a violent pink color on the bottom, had been hitching rides from a friend with a little fiberglass runabout far out into the outside to surf what he swore was the gnarliest break in the world, with waves bigger than Waimea, bigger than Mavericks up the coast at Half Moon Bay, or Todos Santos in Baja. Stuart E.I. on Trans-Pacific flights making their final approaches to LAX reported seeing him below, surfing where no surf should have been, a figure in white baggy trunks, whiter than the prevailing light could really account for. In the evenings, with the sunset behind him, he would ascend again to the secular groove of honky-tonk Gordita Beach and grab a beer and silently hang out and smile at people when he had to, and wait for first light to return. Back in his beach pad, there was a velvet painting of Jesus riding Goofy Foot on a rough-hewn board with outriggers, meant to suggest a crucifix through surf seldom observed on the Sea of Galilee, though this hardly presented a challenge to Flip's faith. What was walking on water if it wasn't Bible talk for surfing? In Australia once, a local surfer, holding the biggest can of beer Flip had ever seen, had even sold him a fragment of the true board. As usual, among the early customers at Huevos, there were differing opinions about what, if anything, the saint had been surfing. Some argued for freak geography, an uncharted seamount or outer reef. Others for a weird once-in-a-lifetime weather event, or maybe like a volcano or a tidal wave, someplace far away out in the North Pacific, whose swells, by the time they reached the saint, would have grown suitably gnarlacious. Doc, also up early, sat drinking Huevos coffee, which was rumored to have double-cross whites ground up in it, and listening to the increasingly hectic conversation, and mostly observing the saint, who was waiting for his morning ride out to the break. Over the years, Doc had known a surfer or two who'd found and ridden other breaks located far from shore that nobody else had the equipment either under their feet or in their hearts to ride, who'd gone alone every dawn, often for years, shadows cast out over the water, to be taken, unphotographed and unrecorded, on rides of 5 minutes and longer, through seething tunnels of solar blue-green, the true and unendurable color of daylight. Doc had noticed that after a while these folks would no longer be quite where their friends expected to find them. Long-standing tabs at frond-roofed beer bars had to be forgiven. Shoreside honeys were left to gaze mournfully at the horizons, and eventually to take up with civilians from over the berm, claims adjusters, vice principals, security guards, and so forth, even though rent on the abandoned surfer pad still got paid somehow, and mysterious lights kept appearing through the windows long after the honky-tonks had closed for the night, and the people who thought they'd actually seen these absent surfers later admitted they might have been hallucinating after all. Doc had the saint figured for one of those advanced spirits. His guess was that Flip rode the freak waves he'd found not so much out of insanity or desire for martyrdom as in a true stone indifference, the deep focus of a religious ecstatic who's been tapped by God to be wiped out in atonement for the rest of us, and that one day Flip, like the others, would be someplace else, vanished even from Nash, the global network of anecdotal surfer horseshit, and these same people here would be sitting in Huevos arguing about where he was. Flip's friend with the outboard showed up after a while, and amid a clamor of anti-powerboat remarks, the two split down the hill.
"Well, he's crazy," summarized Flocko the Bad. "I think they just go out and drink beer and fall asleep and come back when it gets dark," opined Zigzag Twang, who had switched last year to a shorter board and more forgiving waves.
Ensenada Slim shook his head gravely.
"There's too many stories about that break. Times it's there, times it ain't. Almost like something's down below guarding it. The olden-day surfers called it death's doorsill. You don't just wipe out, it grabs you, most often from behind, just as you're heading for what you think is safe water, or reading some obviously fatal shit totally the wrong way, and it pulls you down so deep you never come back up in time to take another breath. And just as you get lunched forever, so the old tales go, you hear a cosmic, insane surfari's laugh echoing across the sky. Everybody in Huevos, including the saint, proceeded to cackle. "Whoo! Wipe out!" more or less in unison. And Zigzag and Flocko started arguing about the two different wipeout singles, and which label, Dot or Decca, featured the laugh and which didn't. Sorta Leech, who had been silent till now, chewing on the end of one braid and directing huge, enigmatic lamps from one theoretician to another, finally piped up. "A patch of breaking surf right in the middle of what's supposed to be deep ocean? A bottom where there was no bottom before? Well, really think about it. All through history, islands in the Pacific Ocean have been rising and sinking. And what if whatever Flip saw out there is something that sank long ago and is rising now, slowly to the surface again?" "Some island?"
"Oh, an island at least." By this point in California history, enough hippie metaphysics had oozed in among surfing folk that even the regulars here at Huevos, some of them, seeing where this was headed, began to shift their feet and look around for other things to do.
"Lemuria again," muttered Flocko.
"Problem with Lemuria?"
inquired Sortilege sweetly.
"The Atlantis of the Pacific."
"That's the one, Flocko."
"And now you say this lost continent, is it's rising to the surface again?"
Her eyes narrowing on what, in a less composed person, could have been taken for annoyance. "Not so strange, really. There's always been predictions that someday Lemuria would reemerge, and what better time than now, with Neptune moving at last out of the Scorpio death trip, a water sign, by the way, and rising into the Sagittarian light of the higher mind."
"So, shouldn't somebody be calling National Geographic or something? Surfer Magazine?"
"That's it, boys. I've had my Barney quota for the week."
"I'll walk you," Doc said.
They moseyed south down the alleys of Gordita Beach, in the slow seep of dawn and the wintertime smell of crude oil and salt water. After a while, Doc said,
ask you something?
You heard Shasta split the country, and now you need to talk to somebody?
Reading my thoughts again, babe.
Read mine, then. You know who to see as well as I do. Vihai Fairfield is the closest thing to a real oracle we're ever gonna see in this neck of the woods.
Maybe you're prejudiced 'cause he's your teacher. Maybe you'd like to place a small wager it's only all that acid talking.
Throwing your money away. No wonder you can't keep your IOU straight.
Never had that problem when you were working at the office.
And would I ever consider coming back? No, not without benefits including dental and chiropractic, and you know that's way beyond your budget.
I could offer freak-out insurance, maybe.
Already have that. It's called Shikantaza. You ought to try it.
What I get for falling in love outside my religion?
Which would be what? Colombian Orthodox?
Her boyfriend Spike was out on the porch with a cup of coffee. Hey, Doc, everybody's up early today. She's trying to talk me into seeing her guru. Don't look at me, man. You know she's always right. For a while after he got back from Vietnam, Spike had been keenly paranoid about going any place he might run into hippies, believing all long hairs to be anti-war bomb throwers who could read his vibrations and tell immediately where he'd been and hate him for it and try to work some sinister hippie mischief against him. The first time Doc met Spike, he found him a little frantically trying to assimilate into the freak culture, which sure hadn't been there when he left, and had made returning to the U.S. like landing on another planet full of hostile alien life forms. Trippy man. How about that Abby Hoffman? Let's roll us a couple of numbers and hang out and listen to some electric prunes. Doc could see that Spike would be fine as soon as he calmed down.
Sorta Leech says you were over in Vietnam, huh?
Yeah, I'm one of them baby killers. He had his face angled down, but he was looking Doc in the eyes.
Tell the truth, I admire anybody's had the balls, Doc said.
Hey, I just went in every day and worked on helicopters. Me and Charlie, no worries. We spent a lot of time in town together, hanging out, smoking that righteous native weed, listening to rock and roll on the Armed Forces radio. Every once in a while, they'd wave you over and go, look, you gonna sleep on the base tonight? You'd say, yeah, why? And they'd say, don't sleep on the base tonight. Saved my ass a couple times like that. Their country, they want it, fine with me. Long as I can just work on my bike without nobody hassling me. Doc shrugged. Seems fair. Is that yours outside, that Moto Guzzi?
Yeah, I picked it up from some road maniac from Barstow who just rode the shit out of it. So putting it back in shape is taking up a few weekends. That and old Sortilege, they're keeping me cheerful.
It's really nice to see you guys together.
Spike looked over at the corner of the room, thought a minute, said carefully,
we go back some. I was a year ahead of her at MiraCosta. We dated a couple times. Then when I was over there, we started writing. Next thing anybody knew, I was gone. Well, maybe I won't re-up after all.
Must have been around the time I had that matrimonial in Inglewood where the BF tried to piss on me through a keyhole I was looking in. Liege will never let me forget that. She was still working for me then. I remember thinking that something cool must have been happening in her life. As time passed, Spike was able slowly to learn to relax into the social yoga positions defining life at the beach. The Moto Guzzi brought its share of admirers to hang out and smoke dope and drink beer on the cement apron in front of the garage where Spike worked on it, and he found one or two veterans back from the Nam who wanted more or less the same unhassled civilian afterlife he did.
especially Farley Branch, who'd been in the Signal Corps and managed to boost some equipment nobody wanted, including an old Bell & Howell 16mm movie camera from World War II, Army